sane people realize that there's something dramatically wrong. There's a culture of fear such that it makes it impossible for them to speak out, because then they're bigots, racists, Nazis, homophobes, etc. The people who did this obtained their credentials fraudulently. They lied. They cheated. She plagiarized. She stole things.
Deliberately.
Unquestionably. It's the worst thing you could do. And instead of trying to be honest and root out the corruption, they themselves are the corruption. These people are completely corrupt. It is the end of the meritocracy.
So what's actually going on?
Okay. I'm going to make a prediction to you.
Welcome to another episode of Heretics. It's Peter Boghossian back on the show. I've interviewed him quite a few times. I'm on his podcast as well, his YouTube channel actually, doing some of his street epistemology. That's what he's known for. He basically goes around putting these things on the floor saying strongly agree, strongly disagree, neutral, and a few other options. And he'll talk about some sort of divisive issue in society. And you have to stand somewhere, and somebody you're doing it with, I did it with Yasmin Mohammed and a couple of other really interesting people, they will all stand in different places, and you have to sort of argue your point or say why you believe certain things. And he's a really interesting person who's very much interested in how we argue and why we argue and how we set out what we really believe, so there aren't misunderstandings in the argument. He is a professor of philosophy and a very, very smart person. And he was known as well for getting involved in the grievance studies, well, for doing the grievance studies affair, which was sending out fake papers or studies and things that he, Helen Pluckrose, and James Lindsay put together, all academics, that were just nonsense, but that got accepted into top-tier academic publications anyway. And they did this to sort of prove how blindly ideological a lot of the people at the top of academia are. So today he is talking about, as well, how far this is going. We talk about Claudine? It's Claudine Gay, isn't it? Claudine Gay, the former president of Harvard, who finally stepped down after she said that it was not bullying or harassment to call for the genocide of Jews. She obviously, you know, she said it it was really bad, actually. I some people are saying, oh, there was some context to it. But I've watched it all, and I don't think there was. But the point was, it then came out, people started sort of scrutinizing a bit, that she had pretty much plagiarized, like, I don't even know how many things, like dozens and dozens of things had come out about her plagiarizing all over the place, which is mad and speaks to the issues at the heart of DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion. You've got all sorts of people who are employed in DEI, who are responsible for hiring people in order to fit certain goals and meet certain quotas, often to do with race. And what is being sacrificed is, of course, academic integrity. That is not to imply that anybody from a certain race or any kind of minority is more likely to cheat or to not be as smart or to whatever. That is not the implication at all. But just that when you don't go for attributes and qualities, and you just go for innate fixtures and things about a person's skin color or whatever, you're bound to you know what I'm saying. Anyway, this is Peter Boghossian. Do go follow him on YouTube and Twitter and all those things. Lots of big episodes coming out soon. Giles Yeo about food and obesity and that kind of stuff. Ian McGilchrist. Christ, isn't it? Well, you guys will know. I should have asked him what it was, really. I probably did and already forgot. That's how my mind works. And he talks about the brain being split into two very different hemispheres who are trying to get on with one another. That's going to be a really, really interesting episode as well. And a dip into some intellectual waters. Isn't that exciting? Sign up to support this podcast on patreon.com/AndrewGold or locals.com. No, wait, andrewgold.locals.com, and you get extra bits and pieces. I think there is an extra bit that we did with Peter, for example, over on there. Please share this podcast around as much as you can, and I'll see you at the end. What is DEI?
DEI is diversity, equity, and inclusion.
What is it supposed to mean, and how is it being implemented?
Well, it's supposed to mean something very different from how it's being implemented. It's supposed to mean you have people from historically people whose ancestors have been historically oppressed into positions of authority or matriculating into university systems. And part of that could be a proportional representation. So if African Americans are, for example, 14% of the population, they represent 14% of the population, or 13 in the case of Harvard's incoming class. What it's come to be, it's come to mean something very different. It's come to mean an anti-meritocratic system in which speech is quelled, and it's quite authoritarian.
Okay, and that's quite worrying. And we're going to be talking today a lot about plagiarism and things like that. Can you just sort of introduce your background a little bit with a reference to the grievance studies affair?
Sure. I did my dissertations in the prison, where I work with prison inmates to increase their moral reasoning so they desist from crime, their critical thinking skills. I went on to, I'm fascinated by this idea of dialogue, discourse, and conversation. And my first book was about talking across ideological divides with regard to religion, and specifically more extremist elements of faith and religion. And then I wrote a book, How to Have Impossible Conversations. I did the grievance study thing. We submitted 20 papers. We wrote 20 papers with James Lindsay, Helen Pluckrose, and myself. Helen Pluckrose is from the UK. And we submitted those to journals in gender studies, the top journals in gender studies. Mm-hmm. And we got busted by the Wall Street Journal after we had 7 in.
So these were fake papers that you had created to see if they could be accepted, just to show one.
Well, they were completely bogus papers, bogus in the sense that the citations of the papers were real, but the ideas that we forwarded were either vile or deranged or some combination of both. The idea was to show that there was a corruption in the academic literature. We wrote a paper, and Jim and I wrote a paper, James Lindsay and I, in 2017, The Conceptual Penis as a Social Construct, which is available
online. Conceptual penis as a social construct.
Right.
So most people won't know what half those, I mean, conceptual social
penis.
Constructs.
Yeah.
So penis, I know.
In this, good.
Familiar.
That's good. So the conceptual penis as a social construct is the idea that everything is a construct to the people who are in the orbit of the ideology. So why not? We argue that the penis was a construct and it was responsible for climate change and a bunch of other things. It's actually a very, very funny paper. But needless to say, people were enraged that we submitted it to a low-end journal, and people were enraged, and they said, this doesn't do what you want it to do, which is to show there's a corruption in scholarship. And if you want to do that, you need to do 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Well, we repeated that process a year later, a little more than a year later. We did 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And then the same people were telling us, of course, that it doesn't do what we proved it to do or wanted to do. But that's just because it's a mechanism to keep the ideology in place. I mean, they'll do literally anything to say, geez, you know, maybe there's a problem in the literature. Maybe it is too skewed one way. Maybe we should be rethinking how the peer review process works. None of that. Nope. Stick to your guns.
That you were able to penetrate, excuse the pun.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah. Academic institutions. I suppose it was hard work to do, but fairly easily ideologically. What does that say about our institutions?
Well, that's a massive question. So let's rewind it a little bit. Among the criticisms were, oh, those aren't real journals, or those weren't persistent. I mean, I hear that, and that's just not true. I mean, Hypatia is Cambridge University Press's journal. It has an impact factor of over 1. Gender, Place, and Culture has an impact factor over 1. I think it's 13th out of 41, and Hypatia is the number one feminist journal in the world. So I don't know. So if people want to make that argument, I don't know if I'll cede it, but okay, then remove anytime someone publishes in Hypatia, they just get it removed from their promotion and tenure basket and make it a laughing stock and a joke. And that would be cool with me. I'd be 100% fine with that. But the idea is you forward that the journals aren't good because you don't want to admit, you know, when we plagiarize Mein Kampf, you will do anything that you can to avoid admitting that there's a problem. So what does it prove? There's just simply no question whatsoever what it proves, that there is an ideological corruption in the peer review process. Now, that takes several forms and manifests in several ways. It's different in the humanities. It's different in gender studies. They forward certain narratives, certain conclusions that they want you to adopt about reality. And then they start teaching those to the kids. And then those ideas are replicated throughout the system. That's the basic idea. There's a corruption.
Yeah. And it tends to be, I gather, are we talking about? No one wants to use the word woke. And that annoys me, by the way, because that was the word that they used. And then once we started saying, hey, that's what's happening, yeah. people are like, oh, what a basic word. That you know, where do you stand on the use of the word woke?
I love it. I use it all the time.
Why can't we use that word? We know, everyone knows what we mean.
Right.
I think. What do we mean?
I put out a series about this. So woke, I translated wokeish words to English in 60 seconds or less. So woke means to be aware of injustices. And you can't be woke enough because there are so many injustices. And it's coupled with kind of a element of restricting speech, an element that racism is the ordinary and everyday state of affairs. The idea that you have to develop a consciousness, what's called a critical consciousness, to detect instances of misogyny, bigotry, et cetera. So you're woken up to injustice. Mm.
And that ideology is dangerous when it supersedes rationality and truth.
Well, it supersedes rationality and truth de facto because it's a lens that you put on that overrides belief-forming mechanisms about evidence and reason. So by definition, it's at odds. But even if it weren't at odds, the I just had a wonderful conversation with the physicist David Deutsch, and he kept referring to this idea of error correction. I think this is incredibly important. The idea that you have to have a possibility to correct your beliefs. You have to have a mechanism that enables you to say, oh, wow, you know, I didn't think of that, or that was not the case. And wokeish prevents you from doing that. It's a kind of authoritarianism, the way that it's been institutionalized in K-12 systems, in specifically embedded within university architecture.
How is it then that really smart people, yeah. I mean, a lot of people who have tenure at universities and things, these are smart people.
Yeah.
They know their history.
Yeah.
They know about things like the Bolsheviks, which is a different thing, but they know it's a group of people who had a very righteous idea,
yeah.
and they put the righteous idea ahead of truth and fact, and everything went wrong. How is it that they are not putting two and two together and making four?
Oh, it's because they're really smart. So in the Believing Brain, Michael Shermer, the skeptic, has a chapter. Really smart people believe. Why do really smart people believe stupid things? They believe it because they're better at rationalizing. They're better at coming up with good reasons for bad conclusions. And then you have a support system in which the people within the university get promoted in tenure based upon whether they publish. But we already know that the journal system is corrupt. You're more likely to publish if you forward the narrative. If you have some kind of paper that talks about police killings or systemic racism or every disparity in outcome is due to systems, something like that. And then the consequence of that is you then start teaching entire generations of people to believe things. But you only are able to do that because you're intelligent. And when you get really smart groups of people together, one consequence of that is they become better in aggregate than if they were standalone individuals.
Better in what sense?
Better in that they can all play off of each other's reasons. So better in that they can cite each other. Better in that they can create bodies of literature. Better in that they can create an illusion that the journal articles, which have been laundered, I call it idea laundering in a piece I wrote for the Wall Street Journal. The ideas have been laundered. They go in as moral impulses and they come out as knowledge, but they're not knowledge. But they look like knowledge because they masquerade as knowledge. You have really smart people, PhDs, academicians, who write and publish in journals, and that it has all the trappings of legitimacy, but it's not legitimate. It's a complete fraud.
And the longer these groups work together and tell one another that, oh, this is the way it is, the more out of control and mad it gets.
Yeah, not only tell one another, but they walk into a classroom environment thinking they have the right answers to moral questions. And they consequently, they test people on that. They give them, they assign their works of their friends, people who ideologically agree with them. And then they're asked to replicate that on tests and essays, et cetera. And then they're rewarded for that. So there's a behavioristic mechanism. And then you do that from an administrative point of view, you make it so that you can't dissent against the orthodoxy, political correctness. You have bias response teams. You have microaggressions. You have safe spaces. Like every single thing that you do in that, again, going back to David Deutsch's idea, which I just love, it removes the possibility of error correction. And so among the victims in this, I know everybody wants to be a victim in society, but the students in this case really are victims because they think that they're learning something and we're doing a tremendous disservice to them. Not only are they not learning something, they're kind of doing a sort of epistemic damage to themselves.
I'm getting an image in my head of, do you know that Disney thing? Is it Fantasia with the brooms that keep replicating themselves?
Oh, yeah, yeah,
yeah. It's just this madness of like everyone like putting out something academic that's slightly off and then someone else compounding that and compounding it. And then we end up with something that is just an amalgamation of nothing.
Yeah, it's kind of like the difference. It's kind of like an amalgamation, to use your word, of the game Telephone, where you tell someone else in a rabbit hole.
Man, yes. I'm reminded as well, there's a great book, The Intelligence Trap by David Robson. He points out as well that point about intelligent people get things even more wrong than less intelligent people.
Correct.
Arthur Conan Doyle is like the icon of that, the Sherlock Holmes writer, master of deduction himself. I mean, he wasn't Sherlock, but he wrote Sherlock. He's the creator of Sherlock and believed in fairies because of some fake picture of fairies.
Yeah, that idea has a pedigree in the literature, and being intelligent isn't a prophylactic against believing deranged shit. Being intelligent just means that you can come up with better reasons for why you believe deranged shit.
That's scary.
It is. And if you want to know something that's even really scary, not to get you down or anything, but there's the one thing that we can't seem to overcome is what's called my side bias. There's a wonderful piece in the Epistemology of Democracy that my side bias is a kind of tribalism. This idea is right. My idea is right. No intervention is successful with my side bias. I have my own opinion why that is, but you can't introduce corrective mechanisms into that machinery because there are deeper things at play. Feelings of morality, feelings of belonging. My community believes this. I don't want to be lonely. I want to be a member of the community. I believe this. Good people believe this. Good people believe this. I'm a good person. I believe this. So you have all these mechanisms that reinforce the beliefs people already have. That's why it's so harmful. That's why, you know, you start off asking diversity, equity, inclusion. The idea itself of diversity as a kind of intellectual homogeneity is so dangerous because you're creating groups of people who increase their confidence in beliefs that are simply untethered to reality. There's simply no evidence at all. But the real danger is that they think there's evidence because they look in the peer-reviewed journals and their teachers who have PhDs assign them these papers. But these aren't evidence for anything. These are just a bunch of people got together who had moral impulses and they put them in a journal and somebody else who has the same or similar moral impulses says it's a good idea. And the next thing you know, they're off to the tracks and they think they have knowledge.
If you sent your child or whatever it might be to university in the UK, the US, Australia, Canada, whatever, that used to mean something. Does that mean something now?
Yeah, it does. It means that they have adopted a set of values that are almost definitely false. For example, assigned at birth. Sex is not assigned at birth. But when you ask any, ask someone, this is what I'd like your audience to do. Go out and find some 20-year-old somethings and ask them, is sex assigned at birth? What does that mean? Very few people will say, nope, not assigned at birth. Like that, it's come to be normative in the society. Well, where do they get this crazy idea? Sex is not assigned at birth. They get it from the academy. The academy is the wellspring of all of this. And yes, it is, as Tim Pool says, yes, we get in a big argument about this. It is, you know, social media algorithms do push certain things, and certain platforms like TikTok reward certain particular craziness around the trans issue specifically. So you have to think about this in terms of an ideological corruption that comes from the universities in which there is no intellectual diversity, there's intellectual homogeneity, and they have a very specific goal, which is to develop what I said before, a critical consciousness in people. And it's not a truth-seeking enterprise. The purpose of it is to recognize power dynamics, to overcome oppression, to find racism, and racism is the everyday and ordinary state of affairs, to find bigotry, to find misogyny. So that's what it means when you send your kids to school, particularly in the humanities, is that you're teaching them to think, you're teaching them to think a certain way, and they're taught by people who universally believe this. And if they don't believe it, then there's a culture of fear such that it makes it impossible for them to speak out. because then they're bigots, racists, Nazis, homophobes, etc.
Hey, it's Andrew. If you're enjoying Heretics, there's another podcast I want to recommend to you, especially if climate change, global conflicts, and an upcoming election are making you feel like we're on the brink of disaster. What Could Go Right is hosted by Progress Network founder Zachary Carabel and executive director Emma Varvalukas. On What Could Go Right, the hosts sit down with expert guests to discuss the world's most pressing issues without resorting to pessimism or despair that we hear so often. Instead, they look back at how far society has come and look forward at what it will take to achieve an even brighter future. Is progress on the way? They may not have all the answers, but on What Could Go Right, they're asking the key questions. Tune in to hear interviews with upcoming guests like writer Coleman Hughes, CNN host Fareed Zakaria, and economist Alison Schrager. If you're looking for a weekly dose of optimistic ideas from smart people, join them every Wednesday on What Could Go Right, available wherever you get your podcasts.
You and I both have a background. I think I started talking about cults and things. I made a documentary about exorcism, so it was extreme religion and things like that. And you also, your academic past, as you say, was sort of cults and authoritarianism.
Yeah.
This all sounds like love bombing. This also, I mean, is that why we're interested in this woke ideology?
Why are you interested in it?
That's exactly why I'm interested in it. I felt like this was yet another cult, just to add to Scientology.
Of course it's a cult.
To add to the far right. The far right doesn't interest me that much. I find it boring because it seems so obvious to see.
Yeah.
Maybe people tell me I'm wrong and that's for them to look into. And I did do some stuff on that. The far left seems much more interesting as a cult because it's hiding what it is.
The far right doesn't control, not only does the far right not control the academic institutions, I said that the academic institutions are the source of this. Not only does the far right not control it, The number of conservatives in academia, I think FIRE, Greg Lukianoff's organization, puts that around 2-3%. So people in the left are overwhelmingly left-leaning. And I would argue that those 2-3% overwhelmingly keep their mouths shut. Mm. So I don't see the far right as controlling. They don't control the military. They don't control the airline. They may control the police force to a certain extent. They don't control... I'm just thinking of United Airlines. Anything in which promotes certain exogenous values other than fiduciary responsibility, like diversity. That is a left concept. There's a left lane. That is a radical departure from Friedman's The Social Responsibility of Business to Increase Its Profits. Okay, so why... So you have many issues at this point. Why has... the left, which I'm also fascinated in because I was living in Portland, I was attending Portland State University. I'm fascinated by how those ideas move and what's downstream of them. And basically the downstream is people pick up these crazy concepts in K-12. They pick them up from the university because in universities to teach in the K-12 system, you need a teaching certificate. They teach teachers, they give them a teaching certificate if they buy into this critical consciousness, racism, the ordinary, everyday state of affairs. The purpose of the institution is not truth, it's to remediate oppression. They go to college and then they hear those things again. So that's fascinating to me about how this percolates through the culture. And that the right has no mechanism for that, none, zero.
Mm. It's still scary, the far right. I'm just thinking, people will be commenting, oh, why don't you ever talk about the far right? And whether they are in control of the institutions or not, the far right is still a dangerous thing. I just think it's easier to spot.
Yeah, well, I'll give them what they're looking for. Am I worried about the far right? Yeah. When the far right start controlling our academic institutions, believe me, I'll be on. When any authoritarian, I don't care what their ideology is, I think that the right and left is not useful. What is incredibly useful is this is a person who's an authoritarian. They want to tell you how to think. They want to tell you how to live. They want to control your life. This person is not an authoritarian. They have a basic value of cognitive liberty. I don't care if you're right, if you're left, if you're a green fundamentalist. I don't care what you are. The problem is authoritarianism at its core.
And one of the problems that we've been talking about a little bit that you've been telling me about, it's not just ideologically captured at these universities and colleges. It's also that corruption, particularly with plagiarism. So what's actually going on?
I just want to say you did a really good job in this interview of talking about the wellspring of corruption first and then plagiarism. Because what people do that they usually talk about plagiarism, but they don't understand that plagiarism doesn't happen in a vacuum. There are entire lines of literature. The whole thing is corrupt. I mean, like literally all of it is corrupt.
Can we stay on me doing a good job?
Yeah, yeah. You did a great job. Just as an example of that, there's a replication crisis in psychology. 50% of the papers can't be replicated. So clinicians going into clinical settings, they're flipping a coin. 50%. Wow. Yeah, it's astonishing. It's a wide scale corruption.
How do you know that?
Google replication crisis, because they've tried to replicate the main findings of papers and they cannot replicate them. Well, I shouldn't say they cannot. They can only replicate half.
Okay.
But, okay, that's a huge problem. So let's talk about the plagiarism thing. I'm going to make a prediction to you. The plagiarism issue is going to become an enormous issue in around 8 months. So let's go through it. Claudine Gay plagiarizes not only large sections of her dissertation, but she plagiarizes her acknowledgments, her thank yous. Like, that is crazy. Like, instead of me saying, hey, thanks, Andrew, for the interview. Thanks, I appreciate it. I'd take someone else's thank you and I'd copy it and I'd stick your name in. Okay.
You should say that's the former president of Harvard.
Former president of Harvard. This is such a big issue. Okay. So Harvard conducts its own internal investigation. They find her innocent before they do the investigation. Okay. So the New York Post wants to expose this. They sick their extremely expensive lawyers on them. They kill the story. Claudine Gay plagiarized, but I want to define plagiarism as the theft of an idea which is not your own, claiming that something is your own, specifically wording when it's not. But there's something else that's really important that people understand. So when I wrote my dissertation, I know 2003, 2004, we had these things called books. And you'd read the books and you'd have to copy from the book to the page. Now you can kind of understand how someone could make a mistake because it's all digital and on screen. But the level of intentionality there from copying a book to a screen without quotation marks over and over again is astonishing. Okay. So she plagiarized, she stole things
deliberately.
Unquestionably. You don't make a mistake. Like, that's why I said you could make a mistake. You forget, you know, you copy and paste. This is the level of intentionality here is black and white.
Yeah.
So she plagiarized. She claims ideas as not her own. She's clearly done it. She's found innocent of internal investigations. When this is exposed that she's a plagiarist, and not just merely a plagiarist, she's a serial plagiarist. People like Mark Lamont Hill and others say this is a witch hunt against an African American. This is a I read comments saying this is a new kind of lynching. It's, you know, mediocre white men attack black women.
Yeah.
Okay, this has nothing to do with race. Like, literally nothing.
Well, it's a disgusting thing to say, actually.
Well, it is, and it doesn't matter who is in what color the skin is, what height they are, what size they are. If you plagiarize, you plagiarize. These are not my rules. These are the rules of the institution. These rules they predated my birth. So like when you plagiarize, like if there's any such thing as a sin, it would be plagiarism in academia. Like, it's the worst thing you can do. She keeps her job. She loses her position, but she keeps her job as teaching at Harvard, making $900,000 a year. Astonishing.
Nice. Just money.
Mad money, right? Mm. 900,000. Okay, so the mistake to think then is, wow, Claudine Gay, plagiarist, it's a one-off. So the moment that happens, what does everybody think? Holy shit, how many other people have plagiarized? I'm going to make a prediction to you. I could be totally wrong on this, but I'm a big fan of not telling anybody, not using words, but predicting things in the future. Let's see if you come back and we'll revisit this in a few months, okay? I predict to you that the number of plagiarists found in the humanities in dissertations of people of PhDs, including the highest levels of academia, the Ivies, I predict that you're going to see 7 to 9% of dissertations plagiarized.
That's startlingly high.
Yeah, I mean, 5% would be 1 in 20. So more, that's my, I could be, if I'm off, I would be flabbergasted if it were under five, like flabbergasted. If I'm off, it's low. My real guess, frankly, would be probably closer to 10 to 12, but I'll stick to a more conservative. So I want to say two things about this that I think is really important. The people who did this obtained their credentials fraudulently. They lied. They cheated. Okay, so what do we do with this? Well, what has the university system done with this? They've taken, okay, so here's another thing that's very interesting. I'll finish the thought. They've taken the names of DEI people off of the roster. So it's very difficult to find these people. And this is like pretty much of a universal thing. They're also starting to remove ethics codes in which plagiarism, what plagiarism means. They're removing those. So instead of saying, look, we have a problem here. We're going to root out this corruption. And if you obtain your degree fraudulently, you're not going to be affiliated with this university. You can do anything you want. You can go do creative writing, whatever, but or work at a gas station. But we're not going to have you in this institution anymore. That would be a way to deal with the corruption in which you could restore public trust. Here's an analogy to think about. In a fire department, let's say that you know that a certain percentage of the people obtained the fire person's exam and they cheated on their exam. And let's also say that there are things on that exam that are essential to the performance of duties, specifically to your ability to put out fires, which is why I assume they have a test, right? Or else there'd be no point in having a test. If the superintendent of the fire department or whatever their title happens to be finds out that people have cheated on the fireman's test, the response to that is we need to find out who did this and we need to remove them. We need to have – the public needs to know that the people working for the fire department are minimally qualified to put out fires. That's the whole point of a fire department. The universities have – now attempted to hide dissertations en masse because they know there's a problem. And the consequence of that would be the further erosion of trust in the system. It's a legitimacy crisis. We have a crisis of legitimacy in the system. And instead of trying to be honest and root out the corruption, they themselves are the corruption. These people are completely corrupt. And I can't say all of them universally, but enough of them universally such that I haven't seen anybody speaking out about the hiding of the dissertation, the removing of the names from the DEI. I haven't seen anybody speaking out about, you know, when Claudine Gay was there. Actually, that's not true. I have seen people and they've been Claudine Gay's victims, like Roland Fryer. Hmm. She didn't like the conclusions. He's black. In a sane world, I wouldn't have to say that. Carol Swan, she's black. But the idea is that she persecuted her ideological enemies and punished them. I mean, Glenn Lowry says that Roland Fryer is not only the best black economist of a generation, he's the best economist of a generation. He's actually a really funny guy when you meet him in person too.
Right, yeah. Right. Sounds, I don't know, I've never met an economist. Well, I probably have, haven't I? I just wouldn't know they're an economist. Okay, and how does this intertwine then?
I know, it's a huge issue. I know. It's grasping this is huge, right?
Because it's bonkers.
I know. It's so big that it's hard. But I interrupted you. Sorry.
Okay. No. You know what? Actually, how do these people who are at the top who are trying now not just to ignore plagiarism but actively to hide it?
Yeah.
How do they square that with themselves? You can only speculate.
Well, again, I can only speculate. I don't have to ask. How do they square it themselves, this fact that they systemically discriminated against Asians for decades? How do they square that fact? How do they square it the fact that they put someone with 11 publications, Claudine Gay, in office, who clearly was not a meritocratic hire? She has no books. How do they square that fact?
The greater good.
Huh?
The greater good?
Well, I think they're beholden to the ideology. They're beholden to an equity-based worldview. It is the end of the meritocracy.
It's mad. You find yourself sort of scurrying around to hide bad things that have happened at your university,
yeah,
and still tell yourself, but this is all in the greater good. I'm still doing this for good reasons. And they know history.
That's what's so frustrating about this. They know that historically people, there's a great Bertrand Russell quote. It's one of my favorite ever. I can't remember exactly how it goes, but along the lines of always do what is true, not what you wish would be good for society.
Yeah.
I think everyone should stick to that.
So when you're beholden to an ideology, you look at data points, anything in your epistemic landscape or your factual landscape, you look at data points, every single thing you do works in service to the ideology. And so we have created a system, and we have no one to blame for this but ourselves. We've created a system in which ideologues are educational administrators. Ideologues have been teaching our kids. Ideologues are giving out those credentials, teaching certificates to teaching K-12 systems. And so we've indoctrinated a generation of people into the ideology. So now once you understand that, and they've corrupted entire bodies of literature. So once you understand that, you can understand why everybody's called far right. You can understand why all this terminology keeps detonating in society, like equity, diversity, inclusion, belonging. You can understand the meanings of these words as they've come from academia, they've been taught to our children, and then it seeps out into the whole culture. Which, by the way, just parenthetically, when I started talking about this, people thought I was a lunatic.
Mm.
That was the problem with the grievance studies thing. It was done way too early. If we had waited, 5-6 years later, when the world was ripe for it, it would have made a much bigger impact.
Do you think people are more ready to hear and believe that this is going on?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think there's no question that people know, especially the left knows that there's something wrong. People who listen to NPR, for example, it's the National Public Radio, know that there's something wrong. They're not quite sure what it is. Gender being non-binary, a spectrum, children, girls who are 16 should have mastectomies, boys should have their testicles removed if they feel a certain way. And 80% of those, Andrew Doyle writes about this in the New Puritans as the Tavistock Clinic has come out. He's going to be one of your guests in your show. Most of these kids are gay. Most of these kids have autism or... So, sane people realize that there's something dramatically wrong, something dramatically, not just practically or instrumentally wrong, but morally wrong, something that's so corrupt and corrosive that it makes otherwise really good, decent people act in utterly horrific ways.
So to put this in a nutshell, we've got an in-group, which is academia. It's one of many in-groups, but it's one particular one that's quite important in our society, in which people have long been incentivized to put out more and more out there theories that correspond with woke ideology, and they get hired and promoted for doing so. And in that pursuit, many, potentially 10%, are corrupt and plagiarizing to get status within that in-group.
No, it's a little more complicated than that. So you have bodies of literature that are devoted to promoting certain ideas about the world, certain ways that you should view the world. And then those ideas that go in peer-reviewed journals are used to formulate public policy decisions. And then you have groups of people who have similar beliefs publishing in those journals. Those people are academicians. They're in the academy. They teach our kids that. They get rewarded for publishing. 7 papers in 7 years is tenure, which is a job for life. They get rewarded for publishing. And so you have a system that is almost made up whole cloth. You have a system that has the trappings of legitimacy, but itself is captured. The whole thing has been captured by an ideology. And anyone who dares to speak out against it will suffer punishment. They'll suffer the bias response teams, which I think are 220 universities. You can report someone for even having wrong think. You can report someone for, basically you can report someone for anything that they want, anything that you want. And there's very little recourse to this, and it is an extraordinary theft of time. I mean, I've been investigated, I don't even know how many times. It's just an extraordinary theft of time.
There are people at colleges. I've got a friend who is actually responsible for that at one of the universities in the UK, who is supposed to look just at plagiarism. So there must be some people in academia still who really do want to root this out. And I've spoken to that person. And they were saying, we've got difficulties now with ChatGPT and trying to work out who's plagiarizing and what's going on. But they really are attentive. But
I don't believe that.
There's got to be some people.
I think that's false. In fact, I can demonstrate to you that that's false. In the United States law, there have been 220 cases of plagiarism. If what you said was true, and if even if I was wrong and it's 1%, which is no possible way that it's 1%, that would be tens of thousands of dissertations. How many dissertations have been shown to be plagiarized in the last 3 years?
Yeah,
so that can't be true. Unless you want to claim that the actual instance of plagiarism is zero.
Well, yeah, I don't
which
know.
Which no
I don't
sane
know.
Person would possibly claim that.
Is it often made public? Again, my friend was telling me there were a few people who have been called in and they've had these difficult conversations. And
yeah, okay. So I'll revise that statement. So yes, there have been people who have found whose dissertations have been found to be plagiarized and they have removed them. So I rescind that. But nowhere near. So if that is at an institution, I would like, and you don't have to say the name of the person in the institution, but they should have found something. So what have they been doing with all that time? Anyway, I call BS on that.
Yeah. Well, that friend in particular has been finding some people. But look, you're talking about a systemic, huge thing. There's always going to be good people working within that.
Yeah. Again, the problem in this conversation is I don't know what those numbers are. But the good news is, so here's the problem. The problem is that there are plagiarism checkers that you can submit a paper to. One of them, a big one, is called Turnitin. But those are not that accurate. There are false positives and false negatives. And the problem is, the fact of the matter is, ultimately, if you're going to accuse someone of plagiarism, that is an extraordinarily serious charge.
Yeah.
You have to have, like they did with Claudine Gay, you have to put the, like Rufo did, you have to put the passages right next to each other. And that, the bottom line, at this level of technology in 2024, that is just a human activity where you have to put them together and check. The other problem is, you don't want people to get away with it because it passes the plagiarism checker. You want to make sure you catch all of them. So there are people who are working, writing these placed on top of a ChatGPT interface that they want to search dissertations by the thousands in batches. And I'm told, I don't have any evidence of this, but I'm told that Jill Biden's dissertation is among those.
Well, we will see then. That's interesting. One thing I don't understand, just as not, I'm not an academic myself. I did an undergraduate degree in English. Yeah. And I remember that one of the hard parts was actually finding quotes. And I suppose, I guess maybe it's different as you get further into academia, but isn't it easier for these people to just put quotes marks around it and say, look, I put a reference. That's brilliant.
Yep.
So why wouldn't they do that?
Well, ask someone who's plagiarized.
Do you have an inkling? Like, why didn't Claudine Gay, she would have got just as high marks, I presume, or grades from putting the quotation marks in.
Why did she plagiarize her acknowledgments? That's even more crazy.
Just lazy?
I honestly don't know. I mean, it actually makes you look better if you cite something because it makes it look like you've done the work.
Yeah.
So I can't answer that question. I don't know.
Just wanted to pass it off as her own material.
Evidently.
Do you think this all leads to what we talked about at the beginning of DEI, what we talked about with corruption and plagiarism, what happened? I know we've spoken about it to death, so we don't have to go into too much detail. Yeah. But the three college presidents, I believe only one of them is still in the job, who was
MIT.
Saying that it wasn't bullying. Yeah. To call for genocide. Yeah. Genocide, wow. Genocide of Jews.
Genocide works, yeah.
Yeah, well, that's what it was, yeah.
Well, I guess a question that occurred to me or has occurred to me that you made me think of again is, given that the people participate in the ideology that is inherently meritocratic, that looks at race as the primary consideration of anything unless it's trans, which has a different status, I have been told that there are concerns that people of a certain identity group were more likely to plagiarize than other people. Now, I don't know if that's true, but if that is true, then it presents yet another complication. Then what do you do?
Well, you just have to take each individual case, don't you? That's the sensible thing to do.
Well, yeah. I mean, that's any sane person would do that. If you plagiarize, it does, again, it doesn't, this is not complicated. If you cheated to obtain your credentials, okay, as a minimum, you lose your job. Now, whether or not you should lose your degree, we can have that. I personally think you should, but we can have that conversation about whether or not you should retain your PhD. But I predicted that within 8 months, the default assumption will be, unless it has been proven that you have not plagiarized, your degree is illegitimate. if the numbers that I'm talking about are correct, 7 to 9%.
And is this coming from the same people? Because I remember as well, James Lindsay used to tweet a lot about these people who were claiming it was racist to say to keep time.
Yes.
It's sort of patronizing.
That's part of the ideology. Yes. Smithsonian
timekeeping, wearing a watch.
Correct.
2 + 2 = 4 is
that's
racist.
Also correct. And that
homework.
Jim has argued with people on Twitter extensively about 2 + 2. They're arguing that it can on occasion not equal 5. I mean, these people are not in their right minds.
Yeah. Yeah. Again, they've read Orwell. They've read it. They've understood it.
Especially 2 + 2 = 4 is in Orwell. Yeah. So the question is, how do you deal with this problem? I mean, this is the most vicious kind of ideological capture. I mean, this is really like the only analogy I can think of is like a madrasa. It's like a madrasa, but it's like a madrasa in which all of the madrasas in the United States are responsible. They're the engines of knowledge productions by which we maintain economic competitiveness. So what do you do? Well, there are only two options for what you do. You try to reform the system or you burn it down. There's no other option. Oh, so you have two options. You build new things or you burn it down. There's really no other option. Like if you can fix the institution, you fix the institution. If you can't fix the institution, then you have to build new things. I'm working on building new things at the University of Austin. I don't think that the institutions can be fixed. And I don't think they can be fixed because you have people who have jobs for life, they have tenure. Anybody who tells you that the institution can be fixed, you only need to ask them one question. Is there a DEI office at the institution? If the answer is yes, then that's a fundamentally incompatible with freedom of speech. You cannot have both DEI and freedom of speech. It's literally impossible.
This has also all sort of fallen apart at a time where some people are making the argument that it's not actually worth, particularly for undergrads or just a degree. Having a degree.
I agree with them.
It's more sensible to be able to just do a job, a task or something.
Okay, so I think that the landscape is going to change with AI very soon, but right now it has not. So if someone's watching this, my advice to them, particularly if you're a parent or a young person, anyone who's thinking about college, I'll give you the same advice I gave to my daughter, who I love very, very much. Go to trade school. Get a vocation. Become an electrician, carpenter, plumber, mechanic. Those are honorable, noble skills, and they pay lots of money.
Do you see that South Park episode about that?
No.
It's or the...
I watch South Park, so I probably don't remember.
It's one of the new ones that they put out on Paramount, and they're like an hour long. These like long episodes, and basically the joke was that nobody knew how to. They all going around, I've got a degree, but then they can't fix basic thing. And then the plumbers and all the people with the trades were going around in like Lamborghinis, gold teeth, and stuff like that.
So that's we've demeaned that, and we've cast a negative shadow on that, which is extremely unfortunate. I just read the other day that the mean IQ of college students went from 109 to 102.
Right.
But not all people should be in college. But even if you want to make the argument that it's necessary for some kind of civic participation or the functioning of civil society or democratic institutions, I'm open to that. But it's not clear to me why that can't be done in K-12.
What's that?
Well, teach people about civics, teach people about American history, teach people about what it means to be a responsible citizen.
Was K through
kindergarten through 12th grade.
Okay.
Yeah.
How old's 12th grade?
That's when you're like 18 and then you go to college. Well, you can go to college after that.
Okay.
See, even I get trapped in that because I'm in that age where that was just a natural progression.
You go to college.
Yeah. And I think that we need to disrupt that. And I think that it's a good thing if enrollments plummet. Until these universities and institutions get their shit together, people should not go there. They're teaching them things that are simply false.
Yeah. And even if they do sort that out, or as you say, they won't sort that out, that it is up for debate. We don't know whether university degrees really are. I don't know. If everyone goes, then you need something else.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you're an employer, one of the things you can do is you can say, well, we're going to look for people with degrees from, for example, the University of Austin. And people have done that. They've said to the University of Austin, we're going to hire your graduates. That's one approach. And the other approach is more negative. I don't like it as much, but it's on the table. If you go to Harvard or Yale or places that have been ideologically captured, don't apply here.
There's a lot of talk from progressive factions about unconscious bias, things like that. I think there is unconscious. I mean, I think you can't deny it. Of course, there's unconscious bias about everything, race, color, everything, beauty. Do you think...
That's conscious bias, but go ahead.
Is that conscious bias?
What, beauty? You're attracted to, yeah.
Yeah, but sometimes you don't realize you're attracted to them. I would say even if a straight male, I might favor another male for a job who is better looking.
Oh, so and then you're not aware of that process?
Yeah.
Okay, okay.
Yeah, that must go on. There was a great book, a short story by Ted Chiang, where who wrote the book that was for Arrival, the movie. Mm-hmm. And they are able in the future to turn off the bit in your brain that perceives attraction. And it's fascinating to think about. What a thought experiment.
Oh, wow.
So they do it in certain schools.
What's the name of it again?
Ted Chiang,
okay.
Chiang.
That sounds fantastic.
Stories of your life. And it's all short stories. It's quite Borgesian to bring out Borgesian, to show off my Spanish. But really, really good and really interesting. And then when they're 18, they're able to choose whether they want to turn it on. And they first realize whether they're attractive themselves and who they're attracted to and all these kinds of things.
Very cool.
Fascinating idea. Do you think, though, that people have shown, this is something I've been wondering about throughout history, that if they can be racist and get away with it in a particular society, they will?
Two things. It's highly dubious that the quote-unquote instruments to test intrinsic bias actually test what they're claiming to test for. And if somebody independent can look at that and see if it does what they claim to do. The solution to a race-based way of thinking about the world, the more meritocratic a system is, the less racism it will have built into it. So you can think about it like this. I hate to talk about this, but I'm going to talk about it. Like 50,000 people. Why did you let Bogosian talk about this? But it really is a great example. Combat sports are a fantastic example. So I was going to use example of jiu-jitsu, but you could just use an example of anything. But in jiu-jitsu, it's purely meritocratic. Like there's no possible way your race could have anything to do with whether or not you can, you know, tap someone out, you can beat them. And the more meritocratic the system, the less racism has to exist in the system, because it's not predicated on make-believe. It's predicated on something that's real. It's an actual skill set. Like, you can't fake it. You can't fake playing a violin. You can't fake speaking, you speak Spanish. Like, we can't fake. You could hear a non-Spanish speaker, like, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
So the less one adheres to that and the more one strays to that, the more possibility that the system is likely to contain discrete elements of slack. And those slacks, those pockets can... It's in those voids where things like racism takes place, sexism takes place, misogyny takes place. You wouldn't need any of that if it was a purely meritocratic system. I mean, how could you? I would argue that unless it was so deeply ingrained in your culture, you couldn't have it at all. But if you had it I'm kind of thinking out loud here, but if you had a truly laissez-faire capitalist system in which the dollar was king, I don't think you could have it either. I read this story a while ago about in Pakistan. These women got together who had been abused by their husbands, and they formed this kind of rug cooperative, and they got a lot of money, and it became famous, and the government eventually came down, and they were pissed off, and they shut it down. In that system, in the capitalist system, I would argue there'd be less of that the more laissez-faire or pure capitalism. So any time you have meritocracy, you have less of the uglier elements.
It's like, I suppose, a soccer team or football, as we call it here. You'd have to be crazy as a manager a coach who wants to win to pick a white player over a black player who you know is better.
That's the Mark Cuban thing when he started talking about it. I almost jumped in on the conversation, but he's clearly talking about something he just doesn't know anything about. He's virtue signaling. And then there was a woman who's short and Asian. She said, if you really want diversity, I mean, I've been saying this for years, but put me on the team. And so I used to believe, I no longer believe this. I used to believe that the only reason that you'd want a diversity initiative is because people would think it wasn't important. like philosophy professors. We need to have so many trans people as well. But I no longer believe that because now it's in the realm of airline pilots. It's in the realm of surgeons. It's in medicine, et cetera. And so the ideological takeover has become complete. I will say that it's been so effective for two reasons. One, hijacking the normal meanings of words, playing on people's moral sensibilities. Diversity is good. You're playing on people's feelings. The other way that it's been incredibly successful is the long march through the institutions, right? And it's in our institutions in such a way that they have shut off dialogue and discourse in the name of inclusion. So we want to make people feel welcome. They can't feel welcome if they're offended. So you have to restrict speech. When you have a system in place that tells you that there are certain things you cannot talk about, the natural consequence of that is you will not be able to formulate arguments against the thing you think you believe. And you will only pretend to believe it at some point.
I'm just worried about time because we've got to go quite soon.
Yeah.
I'm going to ask you another question after, but tell me where people can go and find all your stuff.
Twitter or X at Peter Boghossian, PeterBoghossian. YouTube, Peter Boghossian. Instagram, I almost never use it, but I'm there. Substack, I use my Substack, but we go around the world and we make videos. In fact, you and Yasmin Muhammad are going to go and we're going to make a video doing Spectrum Street Epistemology, where we give people tools to not only help them communicate across divides, but accurately calibrate their degree of confidence in propositions. So that's what we're going to do. It's fun.
Who's a heretic you admire?
Who's a heretic I admire?
There's one sitting off screen behind you, if you're trying to think of one.
Well, Yasmin Muhammad is absolutely a heretic I admire. I love that woman. She's been I've been a fan of hers. I read her book. She's spoken in my classes. The first time I've seen her in real life, I gave her a huge hug when I saw her. I want to just pick her up and hug her. She's great.
I was upset I didn't get the hug.
Oh, well, I gave you a hug eventually.
Eventually.
Okay.
It wasn't the same.
But Yasmin and I had never met before. So.
That's true. Yeah. You gave me a big hug and a lot more the first time. No, you're right.
Thank you, Peter Boghossian, for coming on the podcast yet again. Peter has become a good friend of mine. We talk all the time. We chat and gossip into the early hours, sending flirtatious messages to one another and reveling in one another's charm and company and all of those things. I'm not sure he would describe it the same way, but he's a great guy and he's really nice actually. And we went out for dinner in London. We had a really nice time, hung out with some of the other sort of people he travels with, and it was really, really nice. He's a top guy. And we hung out with Yasmin Muhammad. We were all sort of out together. That was great. And Peter, yes, he's on Peter. Well, just type in Peter Boghossian. You get all his stuff. Twitter, his YouTube channel is absolutely phenomenal. I'm on it. Depending on the time of you listening to this, I think it's coming out in the next few days. I don't really know, actually. But yeah, go and watch all that stuff. Sign up on andrewgold.locals.com for the extra bonus bits at the end of most of the episodes. I'm pretty sure we did one with Peter. I can't remember, but go and check it out. You can also get that on patreon.com/andrewgold. Those are your options. Apple Subscribers also has that on the audio podcast, and it's all ad-free as well. And a way to support the podcast. Thank you all for listening. Please do share this around as much as you can. I hope you liked my little sort of talking to you guys message the other day. I think a lot of people did quite like that. So maybe I'll do a bit more of that going forward. Spreading my opinions into the cyber web. See you next time.